Welcome to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Listen and grow as Del questions the status quo, encourages you to think differently, and empowers you to make a better life. Get ready as Del challenges core beliefs, seeks the truth, and reveals the roadmap to the lifestyle you really want. And now your host, multi-millionaire, national award-winning investor, CEO and founder of Lifestyles Unlimited, Del Walmsley.
Welcome to Del Walmsley Radio Show, where the hype ends and the help begins. I'm your host, Del Walmsley, and as always, we're working on your financial freedom. My friends, working with the younger kids and the middle-aged kids and the young adults, working my way through this younger group of investors, you're going to run into questions that are typically sort of shared to the parents or asked of the parents, asked of, you know, maybe the teachers in finance class or whatever. Somewhere along the line, you have to wrap your head around certain realities of the cost of living. So this morning, because some people asked me these questions, I kind of went and so let me look at what they're teaching people and really how do I see it differently than what they're teaching, if I do at all, and cover that today. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to cover really what the difference is between what I see and what the world sees. So the first one to cover is what does your expense profile look like as you grow up, right? And AI overview, basically. We'll start with AI. It says, a good guideline for how much money you should spend each month is to follow the 50-30-20 rule. According to financial experts, this rule suggests dividing your after-tax income into three categories. 50% for needs. This includes essential expenses like housing, utilities, groceries, transportation, and insurance. 30% for wants. This category covers the discretionary spending such as entertainment, dining out, hobbies, and vacations. And 20% for savings and debt repayment. This portion goes towards building an emergency fund, saving for retirement, and paying down debts beyond the minimum payment. All right, so this is your basic outline that's been the exact same way they represented it to me when I was a kid. It's been around forever. It's the typical idea. So let's take a look at this and let's work through it, how rich people see it differently than poor people, see it differently than middle class. I would suggest this is probably your middle class example of how to deal with finances. When you look at wealthy people, and I'll take myself because I know what I did, if you first change the order of these things. So 50% for needs, 30% for wants, 20% for savings. I change it to 50% for investments. Right out of the blocks. That was the most important thing. And they call it pay yourself first in Think and Grow Rich, in Richest Man in Babylon. All these books talk about pay yourself first. I think that's Richest Man in Babylon. And whether it's the 20% they're talking about for savings here, or it's my 50%, which is what I lived on. One of those two, whichever it is you're going to pick, needs to go first. Why? Because expenses, living expenses, just creep up on you. You don't realize it. You have no idea about it, but it just happens. So you've got TV, you decide to get cable. Then you find that your favorite show or your sports thing's on a different network, so you added another network. So that went from X to X plus $15 more. And you go, what's $15 a month anyway, right? And you just keep doing this. All of a sudden, you wake up one day like I do with a cable bill, cable TV bill that's $400. And so, well, gosh, you got TV on there and you've got your internet. You got to have internet, right? So you got internet, you've got cable TV, you got a home phone on there. And then you've got all these extra channels, extra cable networks you belong to. That stuff just creeps up on you. And if you don't put the savings, don't take the savings dollars out first and put them in the investment fund, they're not going to get out. In most cases, these expenses will just creep up on you. The 30% for wants categories, discretionary spending such as entertainment, dining, hobbies, and vacations, I don't think that stuff wins the battle in early life. I think that's probably wrong. I know I didn't spend 30% of everything I made on that stuff. My discretionary spending was much lower. And then, of course, needs. You know, you have to have a place to live, right? You have to have a car to drive. At least in Texas, you do. You maybe don't in the East Coast. But there are things you have to have. So you look at these and you think about how do you spend your money, right? And my first argument with young kids is, hey, look, you've got a winning hand to play. You're living with your parents. Why should you expand your expenses to anything? Your parents are letting you have a place to live. In most cases, they're letting you eat. You don't need extreme amounts of clothes, toys. You're past all that. You maybe need a car and insurance for that car. And that's it. So your savings at the beginning should easily be 50%. Now, once you build up your savings and you start building some income, and this is the concept that no one can wrap their arms around. Our kids are making money when they're young. You go, there's no way. I'm an adult. I can't make money. Yes, you can. You can put it in businesses, savings accounts, CDs, whatever it is, bonds, and then you get paid monthly. Every single month you get paid money. And so as a kid, if you start out by living at home and saving all of your money, and all might be 80%, might be 70%, but you save it all and you put it in income-producing assets, within no time at all, you've got enough money now coming out to go pay for a place to live. Now when you go rent somewhere, it's not eating into your paycheck. That is covered. Now you can continue to save that larger percent because you've covered that pay. Now, what I did was in the 30s, my early 30s, I started buying rent houses and I gave each one of them a name. I said, okay, these two houses right here are going to cover my mortgage payment. And these two houses right here are going to pay my car payment and my car insurance. And the next two houses are going to pay for my food and my clothes. So what I did was I built up this team of warriors that went to work for me every day and made me money. And when I wanted something, instead of looking at it like, okay, I want this, I would go, okay, how many rent houses do I have to afford this? And instead of going and buying that, whatever that was, I would go buy more rent houses until I could afford that, whatever it was. Now, once you figure this out, guys, you're going to be rich. That's all there is to it. You've broken the entire I'm going to be poor, work for the man code that most people grow up with, because now you're building your own wealth as you grow. And when you're young, you have no expenses. You have no reason to not build wealth, right? Now, if you continue to build up that wealth, you continue to get better jobs, make more money, you can save even more, and you can build the wealth even faster. All you have to do is keep saving and buying income-producing assets that cover whatever expenses you want to add to your life. All right? So now, let's say you're not there. Well, then, you got started wrong, and now you have a lot of expenses. Well, what needs to happen? At that point, what needs to happen is you need to start cutting back on your expenses and live frugally. So you're going to rent the cheapest place you can rent. You're going to drive the least expensive car you can drive that's safe. And that's, I'll come back to that later when we get to vehicles. And you're not going to live extravagantly. You're not going to go out and party every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night. But the more you can hang on to that concept of this distribution being effective for saving as opposed to being effective for everything else, the better off you're going to be. So when I did it, I started it. And I never broke it. Just give you an example. One of the things that I see break people constantly, and you know, remember, I've been doing this for 35 years. I've had thousands of people sit down with me and go over their finances. And one of the, you know, there's always that breaking point. And I'll tell you a couple of things that are the breaking points that I found financially for most people. The first one I see with young kids is broken down cars. One of our kids is going through this right now. He bought a car. It was a brand new car, but it was a almost a lemon, I guess. It's been broken down two or three times, and he had, you know, repair replacement insurance on it, whatever, which was good, I guess. I don't ever buy insurance for those kinds of things, but he did, so because he's a little more conservative. But it destroyed his life. Car breaks down, the engine blows up, burns up. Now they got to go decide if they're going to replace the engine for him or not. If they do, you know, what's it going to cost him out of his pocket in his share of this? You know, if he does get it replaced, and if he doesn't, what the heck does he do? He's got a car, he's got debt on the car, and the engine burns up. I mean, that's destructive. So the first thing I tell people is this, is when you go, when you're young and you're going to buy a car, buy the least expensive car you can talk yourself into and buy it on the longest payment plan you can put. Now, this is diametrically opposed to what everybody tells you. They say put it on a short payment plan, pay it off quickly. No. The first thing I wanted my kids to understand was this. A car is consumption. It's an expense. It's never going to be an asset. Even if you pay it off, it isn't an asset. You still have to put gas in it and oil in it and have repairs done to it. It's not an asset. And it will go down in value faster than anything you could possibly buy. So buy the least expensive. Remember, you're starting out. You're trying to become successful financially. Start out with the least expensive car. I think I started out with something like a Pinto or something. It was used Pinto, which, you know, neither here nor there. It was a terrible car. It was an ugly car. It was embarrassing to drive. But the bottom line, it was cost me next to nothing to buy it. And before I had that, I had, like, my dad gave me his 80-year-old Ford LTD that he had adopted from his company. He drove it as a company car. They gave it to him for next to nothing. Then he gave it to me. And when someone gives you a car, that's a good car. That's the right price, right? So that's what I started with. Then I had to buy my own car. But what I believe to be true is this. After the Pinto, the next thing I bought was a Toyota Camry, which isn't the cheapest car out there. But by that time, I had a good job. But what it was the most reliable car you could buy in the United States of America. It had won every award there was for most reliable car ever. Toyota Camry, look it up. I don't know if it is today anymore, but 35 years ago when I was a kid, it was the most reliable car. And I drove that car. I bought brand new, and I put it on like a 5 or 6 year payment plan, whatever. I think 5 years back then was the most you could go. And I paid $100, $150 a month, whatever it was. But I drove a brand new car. And that car was beautiful. For the 5 years I drove it, it was still beautiful. It didn't wear out. It always looked nice. But more than anything, it was safe and it always worked. You turn it on, it ran. That's what was important. And the reason why you put it on a payment plan is because you need the cash. You don't want to pay off a car unless you buy a used car for cheap, a couple hundred bucks. But if you're buying, you know, a car, whether it's $2,000, $4,000, or $8,000, whatever these small cars cost these days, you put it on a payment plan, you pay by the month because you're getting paid by the month. And you know that if the car breaks down, that you haven't put millions of dollars into the car. There's still debt on it. Hey, the people have to take it back. The dealership have to take it back because it's still got debt on it, right? You say, well, no, they could charge you for the debt. Yeah, but you've got the warranty, and you drive it as long as there's a warranty there. And if you don't, you get an extended warranty, but whatever. But the bottom line is you're paying a small amount each month. When you want a new car, you're going to sell that car, and you're going to buy another new car, and you're going to put it on payments. And you're going to have payments for the rest of your life. So, well, Dale, why don't I just pay it off? Because the whatever it is, the $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, $20,000 bucks it costs to buy one of these small cars nowadays should be buying you a rent house. And that rent house should be paying that car payment for you for the rest of your life. That way, you can have a new car or a new truck, whatever it is you drive, all the time. Because as it starts to age out, you just buy another one. Why? Because you're just going to get different payments, new payments. You get rid of the old payments, put in new payments, and guess what? The rent houses pay for all the payments. So you never want to pay off a car. Now, having said that, I've paid off all four of my cars. So, well, why do you defy your own advice? Because when you get really wealthy, you have more cash than you need. You have more money than you need. So there's no need to finance anything. You just write a check and you're done with it, right? But in my mind, it's still a 5 or 6 year depreciating asset. I don't look at it as if it's an asset. I don't even have it on my balance sheet, to tell you the truth, because to me, they're expenses. They're not assets. And all my cars, whether they're nice or expensive or are just paid for, and they're not a part of my balance sheet because they're not assets, right? When one of them gets old, Want a new one? I traded it. Like, I'm a Cadillac Escalade guy. Always have been. I want to, you know, drive around the car. It's up high where I'm safe. I can see everything's going on, you know, and that's just the way I like to drive. So I buy those, and I've had, I think I'm on my third one. Love them. Every one I've had, I've loved. Before that, I had a Toyota Camry. From a Toyota Camry, I went to a Lexus 400. From a Lexus, which is exactly a Toyota Camry, but the upgrade model. Then I went from a Lexus 400 to the Lexus 430, which was the next model from that. And then I went from that to a Cadillac, or I'm sorry, to a Mercedes-Benz S600, I think it was, which was the giant Mercedes sedan. And, you know, then I went to the S550 Mercedes sports car. Yep, there you go. Cars. They're all a waste. They're all an expense. And we have too many of them. Take a short break. Be right back with the Del Wamsley Radio Show.
Roadmap to creating the lifestyle you really want. Keep listening. The Del Wamsley Radio Show returns in moments. Learn to retire in 5 years or less through real estate investing. Learn how, learn now. Let Lifestyles Unlimited show you how. Get educated now. Text the word radio to 88007. That's radio to 88007. Join for just $297. Lifestyles Unlimited. You're hearing the Del Wamsley Radio Show. Want more life-changing knowledge? Access our podcast and listen on demand at lifestylesunlimited.com under the radio tab. Now your host, Del Wamsley.
Welcome back to Del Wamsley Radio Show. Today we're discussing finances in general and how to arrange your finances. And then we broke off into this other discussion of what are the top financial destroyers that I've seen over 35 years of consulting people. And I started with the younger people. It's almost always the auto. That's the biggest expense in their life. That's the most dangerous thing they have. And wrecking it or breaking down is like the big disastrous moment in their life. Later on in life, the auto becomes less of a problem, I guess, because you end up buying better autos and, you know, whatever it is, I don't know. Or it's just a smaller portion of all the problems you can have in life. The next problem I see is spouse. Number two problem, or this is the number one for adults. The auto was number one for younger people, but the spouse, I cannot tell you. You know, I think right now the number's up to like 75% of all marriages end in divorce. When I was a kid, it was about 50. I think it's up to about 75%. People get married too soon and for the wrong reasons. And that becomes very apparent in a short to medium length period of time in your life. You go, you know what? I can't put up with this the rest of my life. This has got to end. And there's nothing more financially devastating to a family than a divorce. You're taking everything you have and deciding who owns it, splitting it up, tearing it apart, fighting over it, and spending money on attorneys to fight for it. There's nothing. I can't tell you anything that's more devastating other than maybe dying of cancer or, you know, having somebody that's terminally ill and you don't have terminal ill insurance. I can't find a thing that's more devastating than this. And 75% of all marriages ends it. So why do people get married so young? Well, because the man's getting sex for the first time ever on a regular basis. I got to marry that man. I got to keep that. I want to get that on a regular basis. When I was dating, I had to hustle. I had to work. I had to be exciting and fun and stay in shape. And now I don't do anything, man. I'm married and I've got it locked down. The wife, hey, I want to get babies. You know, I want some kids. I got to lock this down. I got to be in a relationship so I can start having kids, whatever it is, or maybe the same reason. I don't want to hustle anymore. I don't want to stay in shape anymore. You know, I'm starting to get older. I'm starting to look older. I'm starting to weigh more. I can't keep the hustle up, and, you know, so I'm not going to go out there and stay out there in the hustle. Whatever it is, you marry up, and then you find out you guys really don't have things in common. I mean, you have a lot of things that are not in common. I was watching Michelle Obama on TV the other day on her podcast telling how she tells her husband, President of the United States of America, don't touch the thermostat. You have no right to touch. If you touch the thermostat, there's going to be a problem. Blah, blah, blah. I go, man, this woman is out of her freaking mind. And She's the president's wife of a president, and she's still that much trouble. And, you know, it's interesting because you think some people, you know, if you're more sophisticated, you have more money, you have less family problem. No. Family problem has no economic divide. Family problems happen with everybody, 75%. So if you could do anything, one, just put off marriage until you're financially secure, or both of them, is get to know the person. I would actually go to, and I have a list. I gave it to the kids when I did the young adults class at the expo. I gave them a list of things that you should sit down and talk about. And if you've got too many of those things you disagree on, and I mean, when you speak to people about the issues that were on this list that I put down, maybe I'll see if I can dig that list up and bring it to us for another day. But if you speak about these issues, and you will find there are issues that you just do not agree on. I mean, radically don't agree on. And if that's the case, you got to decide, is that a deal ender? You know, that's it. It doesn't work. I mean, we'll be fighting. For one thing, I could never see being with someone that had opposite politics as you. If you're a Republican, they're a Democrat, you'll be miserable. Everything you watch on TV, you'll fight over. Everything you hear, all your friends, who's our friends? Do we go with the Democrat friends or the Republican friends? It will be unbelievably miserable. Another one is, what do you think about staying in shape? One person wants to stay in shape, the other person doesn't. Boy, you're going to be miserable having a fat spouse if you're not a fat person. It's just going to drive you crazy. Smoking, one smokes, one doesn't, it's over. Just give it up. Don't even get married. Don't even think about getting married, right? Drugs, same thing. You can just go down the list. Saving money. Oh, my God. That is a blowout decision. Do you save? Do you not? Do we spend? Instantaneous gratification disease versus conservative save everything for the future person. They just will tear each other apart. You need to discuss that. And if you know that, you have to say, are we willing to agree to it? I would even put it in your prenuptial. If we have this problem, we're getting divorced, and here's how the money and everything's being split, because we just couldn't do it. We tried to do it. We couldn't do it. So we're going to split everything. Here's the way it gets split. A prenuptial is an absolute necessity in this day and age. Everybody should have one with every marriage that you get into, because it's a contract. You guys are a partnership. You're a team working together. But, man, partnerships blow out really quick when it becomes emotional distress. So spouses are definitely the next worst thing to happen. After spouses, as we get a little bit older, the next thing I find that destroys people is health. People are getting sick younger now. I mean, they're getting sick in their 40s, definitely by their 50s. And I almost died like 3 times by the time I was 50. So I understand. I mean, there's stuff like I got appendicitis that ruptured and that almost killed me. I don't remember the other. Oh, I got staph infection that almost killed me. And I got cancer that almost killed me. So those three are deadly. Luckily for me, I had really good insurance. I was covered and I had money in the bank. And I didn't have a job that when I got all three of those, I had to quit my job or lose my job. So health and then fitness, which whether people realize it or not, fitness has a lot to do with health. I just don't know how to explain this to you other than, hey, if you're fat, obese, smoke, drink, your life is not going to be the same as someone who doesn't do all that stuff. And that's just fitness. That's just taking care of yourself, right? Working out, correct diet, living clean. And if you don't, it's going to be a problem. And I've seen this over and over and over again where people come to me and go, you know, but my spouse, it goes both ways. My spouse is sick. I have to take care of her. She can't work anymore. He can't work anymore. I've seen it both ways. And or they, you know, they have a pulled muscle in their back or, you know, pinched nerve. Yeah, you weigh 275 pounds. You weighed 125 pounds in high school. Now you weigh 270. Of course you have a pinched nerve in your back. You're lucky your back isn't broken from getting in and out of bed every day. I mean, I'm being critical, yes, but for a reason. These are the things that take people down. You work your whole life. You go to school. You study. You think you're going to get somewhere in life. Then boom, something physical takes you down. And you go, it's not my fault. It is your fault in many cases. In many cases, it is your fault. And even if it's something genetic, if you've got parents that have genetic illnesses, you should be watching out for those and doing the things to take care of them, right? I have diabetes. I have to fight my diabetes every single day. It's how I eat makes all the difference in the world. I take all the medications, but if I took the medications and didn't exercise and didn't diet, they wouldn't work. They don't. My wife's mother was up to 400 pounds at one time or somewhere in that range. I don't know exactly how much it was, very heavy. And then she lost all the weight. And she was diabetic. She lost and just dropped all the diabetes medication. Didn't need it anymore. Just because of weight loss. I'm the same way. When I lose weight, when I go on a diet and I stay lean, I don't need my diabetic medication. My diabetes goes away. My blood sugar stays low. It's just an amazing thing. So health is the next one. And the last one, the one I see people run up against when they don't have the other problems. Life has been good to them. They got a good job. They make good money. They got a family. And then all of a sudden they decide to buy a giant house. I don't know how many people I've met in my life that have been house poor. And it's almost always successful people. So forever people have thought, this is the statement that I've heard my entire life, go buy the largest home you can possibly buy, because what's going to happen is you're going to make more money later in life. When you're young, you'll barely be able to make the payment. You'll struggle to make the payment. But as you get older, the payment will get easier because you will make more money as you get a better job, better job, better job. Over time, you'll pay that mortgage off completely, and that house will double or triple in value over X period of years, 30 years of you paying the mortgage off. And that will end up being the largest asset you have in your life, including and greater than your 401k. That's the story that I was told. That's what most people have been told. And I just don't believe it. Because I look at real estate as an investment, not as a place to live. A place to live is consumption. So I've always kept it in my mind that wherever I live is not an investment. Never have tried to make it an investment. It's always been consumption. So I've never expected to buy a house, live in it for 10 years, and it'd be worth more, although a lot of people do that in in areas where the appreciation is very high. However, when you look at the situation of becoming wealthy, having your money tied up in a personal residence, especially if you pay it in full, is the worst place you could possibly put your money. Your money needs to be in investments, so you need to get it out of that personal residence. But first of all, let's talk about the size of the personal residence. I've always believed that you don't live in a home that costs more than 1 year's salary. So if you make 100 grand a year, you shouldn't live in a house that costs more than 100 grand a year, period. Or 100 grand, period. I'm sorry. If you make 200 grand a year, you can now afford to live in a $200,000 house. And when I was a kid, the first house I ever bought was a condo. It was $40,000. It was what I made, $60,000, $70,000 at a time. And it was the worst thing I ever owned. I had a Corvette. They stole the T-tops and the wheels off the Corvette. You lived there. You couldn't do anything because of the association rules and everything. When I finally decided to get out of there and buy a house and get away from the insanity of living in basically an apartment, that's what a condo is, I put tenants in there, and you know, two women shot their husbands there in that condominium association. So, I mean, it's like a very unhappy place to live in a condo. And I'm not talking about high-rise condos that cost $5 or $10 million, guys. I'm talking about a condo that costs $40,000. I'm talking about condos today might cost $100,000. These mass housing units are a terrible place to live. So I got out of there and I got my first house. It was about $120,000. It was brand new. It was in a nice subdivision, and it was out in Sugar Land. It was a brand new subdivision. It was the nicest thing I'd ever done for myself. And then I realized where you live is who you are. It makes every single day you get up and you see the world framed by how and where you live. What does the inside look like? What does the yard look like? Where do you live? Driving in and out of there, going to grocery stores in the neighborhood. Your living conditions are your life. And I lived there for many years until I made more money, because I had to get up to where I was making $250,000 a year. And then I bought a $200,000 house, which I went from it was 2,600 square feet. I went to a 4,000 square foot home. It was $200,000. at the time I bought it. I kind of stole it from somebody as an investment, but I lived there and I bought it for half of what it was worth, but I lived there. So it was not an investment to me, but I bought it for half. It was about a $400,000 house I bought for 200 grand, but I made it my home. And so it was a wonderful place to live. It was a big, giant home, had lots of room, could do anything I wanted, had, you know, all the fun spots that a house should have. And then I decided to move into the inner city. And I bought my first $1 million home. And it was right downtown where all the bars and restaurants and everything was. And I was living the life of joy. I was blocks away from everything that was fun and exciting and entertaining in the world. And man, I'll tell you what, my life changed. All of a sudden, my life was exciting and fun because I moved out of the burbs into where all the excitement was at. And I was a single young man. So it was great. And I had a $1 million home. It was a 5,000 square foot home. It was incredible. It had an incredible swimming pool. It was just unbelievable. And it was a patio home, so there was no yard other than the swimming pool area and, you know, deck area and whatever. So it was, there was no maintenance and upkeep for me. Just my life just became so much better. I couldn't even imagine it. I didn't ever think I'd leave, except my girlfriend, who then later became my wife, demanded that we leave because I had dated in that house, and I lived right in the middle where all the excitement was. And so she's like, hey, we got to get you out of here. And I said, well, I'm not leaving until I get something better than a 5,000 square foot home. And I said, look, what I need is I need at least 8,000 square feet. I need at least an 8-car garage because I need to put a shop in. I need a gym to work out in, and I want to set up my train set. And, you know, she looked for about a year and a half, and she finally found me a house, a 16,000-square-foot home with a 20-car garage. And I bought that thing half price. I stole it. Somebody was in distress. That home is one of the most incredible places in the world if you come visit it. The backyard is like five-star hotels, pool area or better. It's actually better. So I realized then, even more so from when I lived in the expensive home, the million-dollar home, to now this more expensive home, is that the quality of life is where you wake up. I mean, I looked at trying to buy motorhomes to spend money. Don't like it. Got to take care of them. Got to drive them. They break down. They wear out. I looked at boats, yachts. Don't like them. Got to take care of them. Got to pay for them. Got to clean them. Got to feed people. You got to put gas in it, blah, 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 take care of them. And then you don't ever really get out there that often. No way. I had ATVs and all-terrain vehicles and stuff. Never got out there to use them. Every single day I wake up in the beauty of this home. So yeah, the home is the most valuable investment you'll make. I hope you enjoyed what we did today, and remember always, it's not just the money, it's the lifestyle. See you tomorrow.
Listening to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Want more of Del's unconventional wisdom? Go to lifestylesunlimited.com and click the radio tab. Listen to past shows, hear podcasts on demand, and find out how you can change your life today. The Del Walmsley Radio Show is part of the Lifestyles Unlimited Radio Network.
The information and opinions you hear on the Del Walmsley Radio Show are those of the host, Del Walmsley, his guests, and his callers, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of this station, its affiliates, its management, or advertisers. The Del Walmsley Show is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult a professional regarding your personal investment needs. Nothing presented on the Del Walmsley Show constitutes an endorsement, recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or security.